This is Rabbi Shai Held, Parashat Va'etchanan 57:75. A God so close and law so righteous, Moses' challenge and promise. According to Deuteronomy, Israel's unique God has given it unique laws. If Israel will only follow them, it will be recognized as unique among the nations. Seeking to inspire obedience to the law, Moses offers three arguments on its behalf. First, that the nations will recognize Israel's wisdom and greatness. Second, that God is and presumably will remain near. And third, that the laws themselves are righteous. Analyzing each of Moses' arguments can teach us a great deal about the theological vision of Deuteronomy and of the Torah more broadly. Moses declares to the people, quote, "See, I am imparting to you laws and rules, as the Lord my God has commanded me, for you to abide by in the land that you are about to enter and occupy. Observe them faithfully, for that will be a proof of your wisdom and discernment to other peoples, who on hearing of all these laws will say, 'Surely that great nation, Hagoy Hagadol, is a wise and discerning people.'" The twice-repeated phrase "wise and discerning" is extremely suggestive. When Moses appoints judges, he searches for men who are wise, discerning, chachamim unevonim, and experienced. Similarly, Isaiah envisions a future ruler for Israel who will have a spirit of wisdom and discernment, ruach chochma uvina, alight upon him. When Joseph is appointed to manage Pharaoh's affairs, it is because he is discerning and wise, navon v'chacham. Likewise, Solomon's uniqueness is understood as a function of his having a wise and discerning, chacham v'navon, heart. Since greatness usually reserved for kings and rulers is here attributed to Israel as a whole, Bible scholar Richard Nelson concludes that Deuteronomic law represents a democratization of the special quality that enables just government. Crucially, the wisdom and discernment for which Israel is to be known appear to be thoroughly worldly qualities. When Joseph is appointed viceroy over Egypt, after all, it is not for being pious or orthodox, but for being effective in the ways of the world. The laws that God gives Israel, then, will not just render it a holy community, they will also enable it to flourish in concrete, practical terms. For this text, Walter Brueggemann writes, "It is important that the celebration of Israel is not for some narrow, ghettoized religious passion, but for effectiveness by the norms of the nations." At first glance, it might seem odd of Moses to refer to Israel as a great nation. After all, he will soon remind his hearers that they are, quote, "the smallest of peoples." In an understated way, Moses here teaches Israel a critical lesson. Although numerical growth may be a sign of blessing, it is surely no guarantee of virtue. Sometimes demographic success is a sign only of demographic success. In any case, true greatness is not ultimately measured by population studies. What is at issue in our verse, Richard Nelson explains, is not numerical, but religious and ethical greatness. One can be numerically great and religiously bankrupt. One can be numerically tiny and religiously great. The mark of genuine greatness is wisdom and discernment. Israel achieves its greatness by making the wise choice to obey God's laws. The book of Proverbs expresses the same tension. On the one hand, we learn that, quote, "a numerous people is the glory of a king. Without a nation, a ruler is ruined." For something at least, numbers do matter. Yet the text quickly adds that righteousness exalts a nation. Sin is a reproach to any people. Righteousness matters at least as much as demographics. Moses lays out his second claim on behalf of fealty to the law. Quote, "For what great nation is there that has a God so close at hand, as is the Lord our God whenever we call upon him?" At times in Tanakh, God's closeness to Israel is expressed as a hope. Thus, King Solomon, for example, prays, "May your eyes be open to the supplication of your servant and the supplication of your people Israel, and may you heed them whenever they call upon you." At other times, God's closeness is treated as a fact, a source of profound confidence that the righteous will not be abandoned. Quote, "The Lord is near to all who call him, to all who call him with sincerity." Confidence in God's innate nearness challenges the classic ideology of images, one purpose of which was to guarantee the nearness and availability of the God represented. Other nations seek to bring their God or gods near with idols, but Israel has no need for such intermediaries. For Deuteronomy, in other words, it is not just that Israel is prohibited from making images of God. It is also that Israel has no need for images because its God is so close at hand. For some later Jewish thinkers, the problem with images is that they compromise God's otherness and transcendence. For our verse, in contrast, the trouble with them is that they belie the wondrous fact of God's closeness. Moses puts forward his third argument on behalf of God's law. Quote, "Or what great nation has laws and rules as just, tzadikim, as all this teaching that I set before you this day?" Where verse 6 refers, at least in part, to worldly wisdom, verse 8 adds another crucial element, arguably the most crucial element. The laws that God gives to Israel are just and equitable. The law Moses will promulgate is one that helps debtors, slaves, and widows. Indeed, the watching nations can see that the socially powerless in Israel, widows, orphans, aliens, are treated according to social policies and practices that curb oppression. These may well be Deuteronomy's two most fundamental blessings and challenges to Israel: the nearness of God and just social practice. Moses here makes a radical and sweeping claim. Israel's greatness will be measured by its righteousness. We can now feel more clearly the force of Proverbs' insistence that righteousness exalts a nation. In evaluating a nation or people, Bible scholar Richard Clifford notes, one ordinarily considers its territorial extent, wealth, history, and military might. This verse affirms that the key factor in assessing a people is righteousness, that is, being in right relationship to God. Kings are evaluated by a similar scale. Quote, "Wicked deeds are an abomination to kings, for the throne is established by righteousness." If Israel obeys God's laws, it will be a beacon of righteousness and will thereby be exalted. If it fails to live up to God's laws, its status will sink and it will lose the land. There is something odd about these verses as a unit. Moses begins and ends by talking about God's laws. First, he speaks of Israel's wisdom and discernment in obeying them, and of the impression that this will make upon the nations. Then, he praises the laws for their unparalleled righteousness. But the flow between these two reflections on law appears to be interrupted by a celebration of God's nearness. Bible scholar Patrick Miller makes the beautiful suggestion that Moses is making a subtle but powerful point here, that the nearness of God and the righteous laws are closely related. Consider what Moses will say later, again invoking images of closeness. Quote, "Surely this instruction which I enjoin upon you this day is not too baffling for you, nor is it beyond reach. It is not in the heavens, neither is it beyond the sea. No, the thing is very close to you, in your mouth and in your heart, to observe it." There, Miller notes, it is the commandment that is near, not God. What is happening, Miller concludes, is that the commandment, the law, is almost a surrogate for God. The righteous laws being written on the heart and being kept are in some sense a manifestation of the presence of God. God draws near in the law that God gives. Israel keeps God close by heeding God's word. We ought to be mindful of the danger in all this, because as I have suggested elsewhere, whatever mediates God can also come to displace God. When Torah mediates God's presence, we can become so focused on Torah that we lose any sense of the reality of God, let alone of God's commanding presence. And then we run the risk of being text worshippers rather than God worshippers. The same applies mutatis mutandis to law. When God's law mediates God's presence, we can end up revering the law more than God, so much so that we all but forget the God whose will and presence the law is supposed to mediate. And yet, there is enormous power in the idea of God's laws mediating God's presence. For a people who spent centuries in exile, often wandering and wondering why God seemed so hidden, the portability of God's laws was no doubt a source of immense comfort. The temple had disappeared, but God's guidance for daily life remained close, to be observed and pored over day after day after day. God's laws are intended to enable Israel to flourish in concrete this worldly ways, but also, and even more fundamentally, to guide us in creating a society animated by justice and care for the powerless. Moses' instructions remind us that sometimes numbers matter, but spiritual and ethical greatness matter far more. His subtle weaving of law and divine presence offer us a potent promise, one which Jews have carried with them wherever we have gone, that God draws near in the law that God gives. Shabbat Shalom.